Today's podcast episode is on mindful parenting with Dr. Renee. Renee is a PhD psychologist and specializes in the area of child psychology. I gained so much out of this episode. You'll hear me babble quite a bit throughout the episode on personal things, but I think it's really relatable to most people, parents, caregivers, aunties and uncles. So if you enjoy this episode, make sure you please share and subscribe and leave a review. I hope you enjoy. A space for conversation around women's health through the lens of naturopathic and Eastern medicine. I am Sandy Ross, and this is Her Earth Medicine Podcast. This podcast is multi-leveled. Episodes for patient education to graduate practitioner level. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you gain value from this episode. Okay, welcome to the Her Earth Medicine Podcast, Dr. Renee Keisha.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And today we're going to be chatting all about how mindful parenting and meditation practices can help to create parenting freedom with yourself, who is an expert in this area. Do you want to maybe start by just giving us a bit of background about how you became a specialist working with mindful parenting?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love that. I guess it goes back to my early studies in psychology. And when you're studying to be a psychologist, you start with a bachelor and then you go on to do like an honours year, which can be also called it's a fourth year in psychology. And then you have to choose where you want to sort of specialise in after that in your master's. So it's a long journey of minimum of 6 years. And I decided pretty early on in my studies that I wanted to specialise working with children. And I decided to go into educational developmental psychology, which sort of where you can end up as, I guess, a quote-unquote child psychologist. And I say quote-unquote because I don't really identify just with being a child psychologist. I'll talk more about why. But it is my area of specialty. And as I was studying my master's and I ended up upgrading that to do my PhD as well, I was also working as a therapist. So I got a job really early in my studies when I was doing my bachelor working with young children with autism, doing sort of like holistic early intervention, applied behavior analysis, and going to the homes of these families who had children with autism and, you know, really, really different family environments. So it was such an incredible learning experience. And I was trained by a really incredible psychologist named Yura Tender, who is big in the behavioral space and really brought a lot of the early intervention for children with autism to Australia. So she's been really incredible. But that was where my work with my passion for working with parents and supporting parents' stress started, because I was observing just these incredibly high stress levels in the home. And we were kind of the therapists that would go in to the house and help the parents manage the child's behavior, and we would actually do the therapy and implement therapy, you know, up to 20-30 hours a week with the children. And I sort of could see that the parents were feeling quite disempowered with the system, the way that it was working. And even though we try to always work as it's the same parents as partners and, you know, as therapy partners with the therapists, I think, you know, it's incredibly overwhelming. They haven't done psychology degrees and they're having all these strangers coming to their homes who they get to know over time. But there's a lot of stress for them, and we kind of expect them to pick up and just we say, okay, these are the strategies that we're working on this week, and we just sort of expect them to implement them. And I think as a young and an inexperienced therapist, you kind of think, oh, I don't understand. Why didn't you just do it? Like, I told you what to do. And then, you know, after years of observing these patterns, it started to become very obvious to me that that stress and anxiety and you know, not just a little bit of stress, but chronic stress and chronic anxiety and a real lack of support for their emotional and psychological needs was sort of underlying this behavior that looked like, oh, maybe they're not on board, or maybe they don't get what we're doing. And that's actually, I realized that wasn't true at all. It was, they had so many needs that weren't being met. And that's where I became very passionate about looking into mindful parenting and how we can better support parents as part of a child's program, whether it's a child with autism or a child with ADHD or anxiety, or, you know, children who don't have a label or, you know, diagnosis, which is completely fine as well. We all parents, I think, need support with stress at times. And that led me into my research, which I upgraded from a master's to PhD to create a program and validate it empirically and see whether it was actually effective, which I can talk more about too. But that's sort of in a nutshell how I got here.
Yeah, great. And it fits so beautifully into Chinese medicine, actually. We have a saying in TCM that to treat the child, treat the mother. And it's the vicious cycle, isn't it, of stress being contagious. And we know the role of the nervous system if you're, you know, feeling that nervous tension from someone else and how it can affect the behavior of people around us. Could you maybe dabble into that a little bit more and give us a bit more of the, I guess, physiology behind how that all works?
Yes, absolutely. I love that saying that you said. I totally practice in the same way. I'm so aligned. And I'm a bit cautious and conscious that I'm often, like a lot of my work and stuff that I write in my recent book talks to mothers especially, and I'm a little bit worried about, you know, leaving out fathers. But like you sort of said, that TMC focuses on mothers, I find that they sort of are that often that sort of person who holds the whole family's nervous system. Mm. You know, they're often, not always, their nervous system kind of, yeah, holds the rest of the family. So I can talk more about that. But the physiology of chronic stress in parenting is really interesting. When we fall pregnant, I mean, we have hormonal changes happening right away, happens in our hormones, our brain, our physiology. And then when we have the baby, it continues to change. So our amygdala, the part of the brain that recognizes threats and that lets us know that, you know, we should be more alert, works within the limbic system of the brain, which is then fed memories by the hippocampus. And that will sort of tell us whether we're safe or not. So if we have been bitten by a dog before and we go out to the beach and there's a scary dog there that looks the same as the one that bit us, our amygdala would alert us to say that this isn't safe, and it would, our hippocampus would feed us a memory that reminds us of why we're not safe. And so we would go into fight or flight mode. And anything that is not imminent for our current survival would shut down, as you would know. So our digestion, you know, is not a necessity right now. That will shut down. Our immune system, our reproductive system, while other things will speed up, like our heart rate, our blood pressure will change. We'll have blood pumping through our body, adrenaline, cortisol, and all of these stress hormones. So that's really useful when we do need to actually run away from a really scary dog that might bite us. But it's really unhelpful when it's happening in day-to-day life. And the reality is that a lot of the time we're being triggered by our children first thing in the morning, you know, trying to get them to school on time. Sometimes it's like the trigger, that scary dog, is actually the clock. And we're trying to get out the door on time, or we're trying to get our child to listen or to follow instructions, but our body is in this fight or flight response where, from all our body knows, from a physiological perspective, you know, we're about to get eaten by a tiger. But in reality, we're going in and out of this response all the time. So I think a lot of the time that mothers who, you know, have all these changes where their amygdala becomes extra sensitive so that they can respond to their baby and their baby's cues, and then their toddler, and then they might have another baby. It, because they're constantly in a state of stress, it almost spirals to a place where, you know, the amount of parents who might have, say, two young children or toddlers, and they're just not able to break this cycle of stress, because it's just been getting worse and worse over many years. And something that we know is that the stress and triggers are cyclical. So once we're in that pattern and we wake up in that state, we might have 20 triggers a day and little releases of hormones. We wake up the next day and it continues. It doesn't just disappear. Even if we go on a holiday or if we do something, go get a massage, it might reduce for a little bit. But if nothing changes, nothing changes. So we just end up in this pattern for a really long time, and to the point where I have seen parents go through, I was, one of the patterns that I was observing was a parent having autoimmune conditions of these children who I was working with. I was like, oh, there's something here. There was young parents having chronic illness, chronic health problems, chronic stresses, and you know, I was like, this is a pattern. And, you know, obviously I'm sure that your work, you know, recognises the inflammation and the chronic stress that leads to not only psychological health problems, but also physical health problems as well.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely see a pattern there from how cortisol, I guess, is that main dominant stress hormone there, and how that can affect so many systems within the body, from the gut to the hormones to the moods of the child, anxiety and so on and so forth. But I guess the other thing that I was just wondering about that you could dive into with what you were just saying there is what the end result of everything you just discussed is the chronic guilt that mothers feel after all that, you know, the stress that we put on ourselves, I guess, around our children, the organization, the constant need for perfection to try and keep on top of things in the day-to-day life that we live, which is so, you know, it's just pressure that we put on ourselves. It's a perception, isn't it? There's no real danger. But yeah, so I guess at the end of all that, like, I personally can experience that after a couple of clinic days, and I'm just like, military mum, okay, everyone, brush your teeth, have a shower, let's get to bed, read a book, you know, wake up, have the clothes out. And then if they're not following my orders, I'm not that calm, cool, collected mum that I might be on, for example, my Thursdays and Fridays when I'm not in clinic. And then, you know, by the end of my Wednesday clinic days, I might be feeling pretty guilty that I've been such a hostile mum. So what are some of the tools that maybe we could implement into that cycle to try and, I guess, break that depletion that can come from the end of that? You know, I'm only into 6 years of parenting, but one of my patients that I just spoke to prior to chatting with you, who's over in the States, she's late 50s. She's got a couple of teenage daughters, and she just said 19 years of putting herself last and putting her children first, and now she's getting all this negative feedback from her parenting from her daughters, and it's causing her depression. And it's like something we need to do to fill ourselves up, to stop that end result being that we're so depleted and depressed at the end of giving everything that we do for our children.
Oh, there's so much to unpack there.
Sorry.
Absolutely. Okay. So, yeah, thank you for sharing honestly and candidly. And I think really anyone who has children who says that, you know, it's not stressful, it's all joyful 24/7 is probably not lying. So, you know, it's nice that I think on podcasts and the way that we share information, you know, we're getting in the habit of being more honest about what the struggles are, even when we are feeling really grateful and, you know, all the gratitude and joy that comes with being
totally
as well. So I think it's important that we're all really honest. And let's start with your example of your client. And you know, I think there are a lot of mothers and fathers, but, you know, when I say mothers, just please know that we can use that interchangeably with parents as well. And there are a lot of parents and, you know, mothers in this case where they might be approaching that midlife, or, you know, their children are grown up and there's sort of been this systemic shift, you know, all over Instagram and everywhere. We're starting to look back on our childhood and understand how our family systems have shaped us, and there's all of this new work around trauma and what trauma is and what trauma isn't. And there are so many benefits to all of the information out there. I really love aspects of it, but I see the harmful sides of it too when I have, you know, 15-year-old clients coming into their sessions with their TikTok videos, and they're telling me about their symptoms and coming up with diagnoses for themselves based on a TikTok follower, you know, person they're following, and, you know, they're linking it back to their trauma, and then they're telling their parents, and it's, you know, this lack of containment and guidance that I think all of this information has brought is a little bit frightening in the mental health realm. So I think it's a bit of a balance. Obviously, with everything good comes like the, you know, yin to the yang, and there's always something counterbalance. So we need to be really careful about that information. So in turn, what's happening is all these young people are learning all these things, and then they're turning to their parents, and there's a lot of like blame and shame. And I think when we talk about like parenting styles and improving generation to generation, because we're learning more information, it's really important that we hold that that understanding that people are usually always doing the best that they can with what they know at the time. Like, you know, my parents didn't have the access to the information that I have, partially because the research that I'm talking about didn't even exist then. So to expect them to parent in a way that I might intend to is completely unfair. So I think when we are looking to do some work on ourselves from our own childhood, it's really important that we keep that in a safe space where it's not just blaming our parents, but it's having the same compassion for them that we wanted as children, perhaps. And yeah, there is that danger of parents going down those shame spirals of feeling really, really overwhelmed and full of regret and guilt about, you know, how things were back then. And women especially, you know, they weren't supported well either back then. You know, we've come a long way with empowering women, so that impacted how they would mother and parent and model for their daughters and things like that. So there are so many layers systemically to that, that I think we have to come back to a compassionate place and be fair, and to also own our own work, be accountable. And if we're a young person and we want to work through something about our childhood, there's no need to talk about it even often with parents. Sometimes it might be if you're in family therapy, but a lot of the time it's about going within, and it's not something that we need to, you know, have mended or to discuss in a setting that's outside of our therapeutic setting. So I guess that's my stance on that part of it, because otherwise, you know, we just want to come back to what's constructive about this other than the blame, and coming back to compassion for everyone involved and a bit of a deeper understanding of that. And going back to what you mentioned about your experience of like, yeah, the more busy you are when you're in clinic, you're coming home, you really need people to follow the routine, right? Yeah. On those days when you're in clinic. And then, you know, Thursday, Friday, you're like, I can do this mindful parenting thing because I have time and space and everything's feeling flowy. So I think one of the things that I would just recommend to parents is to just, you know, have that self-awareness that that's their needs on those days. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday are those days. And I totally relate to that, because on my clinic days, like, I'm just a bit more tense and a bit more rigid around my routine and schedule. And when you're working with people and you've got appointments, it doesn't feel good to be running late, or to be, you know, because then if your first one runs late, the rest of your day runs late, it creates a bit of an anxious, antsy feeling for the day. But when it comes to parenting, I think the best thing to do is just bring awareness that this is my need today, and that sometimes when kids aren't following what we need, it's because it's not their need, it's not on their mind. And sort of reminding ourselves that we're feeling this because this is our trigger, and working through that trigger in a way that sort of helps us to self-regulate, to recognize why, and to build rhythms and routines that support us around that, whether it's like, you know, I drop the kids off half an hour earlier than what I need to, just so that you've mentally got that time to drop them off, to sit in the car and do 10 minutes of deep breathing before you go into that clinic space where you're expected to hold that space for other people. Then I know that as a therapist, it can be hard that when we're frazzled, like, hey, I need to self-regulate so that I can hold this for all my clients who I have today.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I could just send my kids to bed fully dressed for the day with their shoes and socks on, and my morning would flow really easily. But yeah, it's definitely around the awareness, and I guess having compassion, like, it's a big one that stood out to me. Kids don't, it's not their role to wake up and get dressed and be off, rushed off somewhere. Their role as a child is to have fun and play, and so I guess the compassion is the biggest thing there. And relatable to, like, my client that we were discussing before, you know, with her children and how they're putting a lot of blame, I guess, onto her. And there's a really good TED talk by Kristen Neff, Dr. Kristen Neff. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her, and it's on self-compassion. And that, you know, makes so much sense, that talk, because it's all connecting back to when we're critical on ourselves, that then is stimulating our fight, flight, freeze response once again. And then it's just putting ourselves back into that vicious cycle. So I really highlight the compassion that you just threw out there, because that's a huge thing for us all as parents to constantly give to ourselves, not just to our children, but to ourselves for sure. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I definitely recommend Kristen Neff's work, and that is the perfect resource for parents who are in that state. And I guess I also would say to that, you know, that 50-year-old who's experiencing that, to know that they are still the parent now. And, you know, in some of my work, it's about having practices that helps us to get out of our own I stories and ego about our life, and the I stories that we create are part of who we think we are and how we define ourselves. So if that mother defines herself as, you know, I was a great mother and I was this, and, you know, my life had meaning because I raised these children in this way, and then they're saying, well, no, you didn't, I'm not happy with how you did it, you know, that creates this conflict, and how is she going to move past that? So part of that is coming back to realize that these are just all stories that we have and construct about ourselves, and they actually get in the way. And perhaps what her children are seeking right now, she can still embody mindful parenting now. It's not too late just because her children are older. They want to be heard. They want to be seen. They want to be acknowledged. They might want a repairing discussion. And she can still achieve all of those things now, maybe with her own supports in place. But it doesn't mean that it's too late to repair. There's a lot of self-compassion that we have to hold for ourselves as we move through that process. But she's still a mother, and she can still role model how to be able to hear that feedback and not sort of create this story about being a bad mother and make giving it extra meaning. Practices like meditation can really help with that, because it helps us to get out of this part of our brain which is in the default mode. It's basically running on stories and ruminations about the past, which is probably happening for her, where she's just going over and over everything she did, everything they're saying she did wrong. And at some point, yes, we can recognize and repair the past, but at some point we have to come back to the present. So she has this opportunity to model this for her children now, regardless of what has happened in the past. She has this new opportunity again and again to come back, model for them how to accept. And sometimes acceptance means accepting that our children's reality is different to our reality. So in the case of your children, you know, like you said, they want to play, they don't care if their shoes are on, they want to, you know, do whatever they want, have a fun morning, and you're like, I need you to get your shoes on and get in the car and let's go, you know. So we can also accept that we have different experiences and realities, and that children have intense emotions, and they might have actually felt something that we feel is unfair. Like they might say something like, I felt abandoned. And as a parent, we're like, what do you mean? Like, I met all your needs. How could you say that? But it's okay for us to have, we can bring acceptance to having different realities or different perceptions of that situation, and bring empathy for their experience and the way that they saw it and felt it at the time, and empathy for our experience without making one or the other wrong. Practices like meditation and stuff can help us to come back to that place where we're not so obsessed with being right or proving them wrong, because we need to maintain our identity of being a good parent. We can kind of get past our ego in that way and reconnect with our children at any age, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. Thank you for going into all that. Would a good way to perhaps, sorry to bring it back to my story, but I think this might be good for many listeners, because I'm sure I'm not alone with my morning routine situation with young children. But I guess with the mum guilt, like I was talking about, that can come at the end result of organisation, having young kids, trying to get them to school, do the lunches, do all the things, is perhaps, you mentioned acceptance and empathy. Would we be communicating this to our children? Like, I know you'd like to be playing now. However, mummy's got to go to work, so we can do X, Y, and Z, or something like that. Like, what are some little practical tools in the moment we can do so that perhaps later on we don't have that kind of mum guilt that comes up?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good question. And that's exactly right. Like, I think being able to slow down a little bit so that we can actually tune into their emotional state or their agenda at the time and recognize what they might be feeling or experiencing. So like you said, you know, I know that you want to go and have fun now, that makes sense. I'd love to come and play with you, but redirection to what you need them to be doing. Using language like that is always great. If it's in a sense, it's you know, that's a sort of a lighter example where no one's sort of in conflict or melting down, but it's obviously harder to do when maybe the children are fighting or one of them is having a tantrum and we need to get out the door because our heart's racing and we're just like, we might just yell and we're like, get in the car, you know. And it's harder then, but actually more important. So recognizing their emotional state and labeling that. So I know you're really angry, you look really distressed, this is really hard for you, I understand you don't want to go right now, but here's why we need to. And giving them words and language is a really useful way to support them through those transitions, because one of the things that children do when they have these intense emotions that they can't self-regulate often without a parent to help them co-regulate, is when we don't give them any words, so we're not helping them to label their emotions, we're not saying, you know, you look worried, or I understand why you feel anxious, or, you know, this happened and that was overwhelming for you, they're actually creating these stories in their mind or in their subconscious. So let's say in the morning, if you yell or snap at the kids and you just like, get in the car, you know, there's a big rupture, they leave, they go to school, everything's, you know, you've said things you regret, you're driving to work, you feel really guilty, then the child goes off and they will create a story about what happened. Oh, I'm a bad child, I'm always getting in trouble. But if we give them those words of, I'm feeling a little bit rushed right now, it seems like you want to do something else, but this is why we're getting in the car, you're creating the story about what's happening for them. So this is something that we can do with children when they're anxious or when we're setting behaviour boundaries with them, is helping them to create a helpful story. Because when children come back 15 years later and they're like, I felt abandoned, you were so angry, maybe that was their experience that they made up in their mind or that they experienced in their mind, but we could have avoided that by tuning in and explaining the different perspectives and different why the boundary is in place. And I love telling parents to explain a boundary because it holds the parent accountable to understand why they've got it. So, for example, if they're like harping on about like, go pack, pick up everything in your room right now, and then, you know, I'll ask them to explain why they might hold that boundary. And when the answer is constantly, because I said so, because I said so, because I said so, we can recognize that we're in the habit of nagging. We're falling into that trap of just nagging, they ignore us and we get frustrated, which is not helpful for anyone. But when we can articulate that this Mondays are a busy day for mum, I really need you to do this by this time, I'm going to come back in 10 minutes so that we're on track, we have a good sort of understanding of why we're setting these boundaries with children, which I think helps us to realise and to come back to recognising when our interactions are becoming very transactional with kids. Like, as you would know, on those days when you're busy, things can very quickly get transactional, quickly get in the car, we've got to go here, we've got to go to sport, and there's no room or space for connection, versus on the days when you've got more space and you kind of have those times to connect. So I think it's good for parents to have these little practices that help to flag, like, oh, there hasn't been much connection lately, let's find a way to bring it back into our routine.
Yeah, okay, that's really helpful. I feel like I'm getting a lot out of this conversation. This is great. Thank you, Renee. What about with the timeline of things? Like, where do we set time to basically, I guess, have these clear intentions and boundaries discussed? Is it in the moment that it works best? Is it something we might do like a day before a situation's coming up where we know we need to, I guess, well, like before the school week starts, for example, or before we're going to a certain event or something? Where does it work? Where does it fit in best for the child to really digest and understand what the, you know, communication boundaries are required of them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think really it depends almost entirely on the child, their age, their developmental stage. Some children are super forgetful compared to other, you know, completely depends on the child and their routine and what we're working on. But I think more importantly, a good question to ask is, how do the parents create that space to reflect and work out when they need a circuit breaker? So, and that's different for everyone. Like, some people have a daily practice where they love to get up that little bit early before the kids and have that moment to reflect on what's coming for the day, you know, what their intentions are, and sort of set up the day from a really intentional place. And then some parents might have that their kids go to bed and they take a few moments to reflect afterwards. I mean, sometimes they're just so exhausted that it's unrealistic. And then, you know, others might implement a routine on the weekend where they have time or with their co-parent or partner, and they might come together and go, how are we going with these things? So I think I always encourage parents to work out a way that sets up these practices to stop and pause and reflect, because sometimes, you know, we can go a year without stopping to think, and we've been having the same issue come up again and again. We just need to sit down and go, like, what is maintaining this? What boundary am I not setting? What am I not communicating clearly? And children can just adapt really quickly when we're consistent. Consistency is probably the most important thing for most children. And I've got a couple of kind of like templates that I've got in my book, where it actually breaks down heaps of case studies and examples towards the end of it, with just practical examples about different parents and how they started to reflect on setting these intentions and how to actually make behavioural changes for themselves. But for the child, yeah, it's completely dependent. I mean, we can tell a child, okay, this week we're going to try and get ready for school on time. By tomorrow, they're going to have forgotten most of the time. So we need to go, okay, what environmental factors am I changing? Am I doing? How am I communicating with them to remind them, whether it's using visuals or you know, timers. There's plenty of things that can be helpful, or a schedule, helping giving them a visual schedule to follow or flow through in the morning. But I think it comes back to having those reflective practices as parents, so that we're like, oh, that didn't work, or that's working well, or this is why that's getting worse, and just taking that time to think, which is why seeing a therapist or a psychologist can be really good, because they'll check in like, oh, how's that morning going, or how's that thing going, and they're like, oh yeah, actually, you know, he's been toileting really well lately, and I hadn't stopped to think. But you know, you don't need to have a therapist or a psychologist to do that on your own as like an introspective practice.
Yeah, accountability, it's very important, isn't it?
Yeah, and helping us to just check in with ourselves, in a, not in a like a disciplined way, but in a like a self-nourishing way.
Yeah.
Like, how am I doing? And then if the kids are just like a nightmare that week, we might recognise like, well, I really need to go to yoga. I need to go get a massage.
Mm.
I need a day out because I am depleted. And going, that's completely okay. I just need to organise that, you know, for next Friday or whatever. I need to book all that in now because I need to break this cycle or this circuit. So that's completely fine as well. It might not be the kids. It might be about us. But being able to recognise that and to self-nourish with whatever we need, I think is even more important. That was something that our parents didn't often model for us that well, because that idea of like being a selfless woman and, you know, sacrificing all of our needs. But really, like, what I write about is that our children's needs are our needs. So if our needs aren't met, we can't meet their needs, right?
Yeah, so beautifully put. I love the way you really connect how the child's need is so reflective of our needs. It's just so important to really enhance, fill our cup up so we can pour to others. And could you maybe go into a little bit about how, you know, these emotions can be quite contagious? You know, if I see a lot of kids with maybe ADHD, autism, anxiety is a really common one we see with kids now in clinic, you know, and I tend to see a massive patterns with the parents. You know, maybe the parent is suffering from anxiety, or the parent is very wired, potentially undiagnosed ADHD, but has those tendencies towards ADHD. And, you know, sometimes we have to indirectly treat the parent to support the environment of the home so that that can then relate to the child, obviously while supporting the child. But could you maybe touch on that area a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start by talking about a little bit of research that I came across when I was researching some of the work on this contagion between parent-child anxiety. It's really interesting. So in twin studies where two biological twins have been separated at birth and one twin has remained with their biological parents and one has been adopted by non-biological parents, I guess from an old school perspective of like, we inherit our genes and we inherit the DNA of our parents, and if they have ADHD, we have it. If they have anxiety, we have it, because we know these patterns exist. We talk about that with what our genetic, I guess, susceptibility or inheritance is, or family history of, you know, whatever it is. But when we look at these patterns, we would expect, probably a lot of people would expect, that these children would reflect the patterns of their biological parents because it's in our DNA and genes. But what a lot of this research is showing, that these children are actually more likely to mimic the parent who is parenting them. So the children who were with their biological parent, if their biological parent had anxiety at age 7, then they might have been more likely to have anxiety at age 7. Say the child is with an adoptive parent who's not biological, they're still more likely to mimic the patterns of the non-biological parent, which I think is really interesting, and also their childhood patterns. It's quite amazing, and it comes back to epigenetics, which is we are born with a set of genes, but our environment and our lifestyle and our modeling shapes them, and they change over time. So when we have say we're a parent who we have, you know, a lot of anxiety, or we've had an anxiety disorder, we have a child, we're worried about kind of passing that on, because we know in the literature that if a parent has it, the child might be at greater risk of having it. We're not fully disempowered to say, just because I've got this, my child's going to have this. Because if we are able to seek treatment, therapy, to implement, which I think with things like anxiety, it's very holistic, treating our nervous system, working with our nervous system, learning practices that help us to regulate, if we're able to address that in a way where we're not sort of projecting our anxiety onto our child, and to manage that with the right supports in place, then that can definitely be a way to, I guess, support the child's mental health. And we've got to remember that, you know, a lot of parents would meet a criteria for something. We're all human and we might all have symptoms, but having that self-awareness of when our anxiety is getting really bad, or if we do have ADHD as a parent, recognizing how that impacts our parenting and bringing in supports around what that looks like. So it might be like, for example, a lot of people with ADHD or adults might tell me they find it really hard to keep their house organized, and, you know, the family's a bit chaotic. So it's like, okay, well, what do you need to support that? It might be a psychologist or therapist, or it might be a cleaner once a week or a fortnight. It might be someone to help you come and get organized every fortnight with your calendar, or a visual system that works for you. So sometimes it's really practical supports that we need. It's just having that willingness to recognize what, how it affects us, how we can set up structures and supports in a way that will help our children and parenting too, if that makes sense.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And it makes so much sense. My older sister has ADHD, and she's quite happy with the way she has her home, which to me is chaotic and would create chaos in my head. But that's how she has to function. You know, everything is visual to her. She can find things, she can do things. But, you know, for me personally, my mind space is chaotic if I was in that. So I need to have that kind of calm, clean environment. And personally, I probably have some of those ADHD tendencies because a lot of my family members have them. But epigenetics has come into it, where I've really taken hold of meditation, yoga, diet and lifestyle, acupuncture, breath work, and, you know, creating a space for my mind to feel calm. Otherwise, I am in that chaos story. And, you know, it also brings it back to, I guess, out with our mindful parenting, you know, or if we want to practice mindful parenting, or if we practice mindful parenting, because I guess the highlight reel of social media can also really create extra stress for us as parents too. You know, like, kind of digressing a little bit, but you know, my sister will happily put half naked children playing, you know, mess everywhere, where my perception of, oh, the ego comes through with having to, you know, I guess not put that stuff on social media. But coming back to, you know, the support network, like, if I've got a tidy house, I've got that support, you know, I'm quite comfortable and happy with allowing myself to be a bit more vulnerable. And that then reflects on my children. I know they're going to be more calm if I'm more calm, but it's, I guess it's where everyone's at with what they need, with what works with them. I don't know where I'm going, but basically coming back to, like, the environment, like you said, getting a cleaner in and having that house nice and tidy will help someone with that kind of mental aspect, versus, you know, if the house is constantly chaotic, going and seeing a counselor might not be what they need right now. They might actually really need that actual physical support with getting their house tidied and organized so that they can calm down, and then their children can be reflective of that calm environment.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. And I think what you were kind of getting at is that we all have different values. So for a parent who is maybe like, likes, doesn't mind a bit of chaos, is a bit more spontaneous, likes the messy play, like, maybe their values are around adventure and spontaneity, and you know, they don't really value order and calmness. You know, it's just different values. It's not right or wrong, versus I definitely feel like I'm personally a lot more like you, with liking a little, you know, clean environment. I'm very aesthetic. I like my home to be very calm because it's calming for my nervous system. We all have our own, you know, preferences that help us to feel regulated. So I think it's important to be clear on our values as to that's okay that we have different values, but also recognizing that when we become too rigid in any way, that's where we start to fall out of balance. So for the person who's really loves spontaneity and things like that, they need to be careful that if they fall too far out of balance, that children do need some sort of routine and they need some sort of structure. And that when we don't have any of that, because we're just ignoring it, we're avoiding the mess, we're just leaning into the chaos because it sort of feels comfortable, that can negatively affect children, and they might be a bit all over the place with their emotions, especially if they have a different temperament to the parent. And then coming back to people who might be more like me and you, who like that more structured, calm, clean environment, and then we can go out and play and stuff. You know, if we don't check in with ourselves, maybe sometimes we like can't be present because we're too fixated on cleaning, or like, yeah, I'll get to that because I have to have this done now. And, you know, it helps us to feel regulated within the home. But on the flip side, we can miss those moments of mindfulness where you look at your sister, you're like, I wish I could just put my hands in the paint, but not today.
Yeah, no, you define that so well, because I sometimes wonder about, you know, the whole mindful parenting, you know, this whole world now around mindful parenting. What is it really? Because you've got these beautiful mums on Instagram, you know, they look so together, they're so boho, you know, the house is all organized, but they're doing all these creative craft plays with leaves and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, and I think, oh, when I do that, it just becomes, you know, chaos for me, really. Like, stuff gets everywhere and I'm always like, ah, you know, so I have to set up a place for that to actually be allowed in the environment that I don't mind all that happening, versus like my sister who, I wonder if she'll tune into this episode, but, you know, like, she'll constantly just be posting things which is just complete chaos in her home, and she's so okay with it. So, you know, the highlight reel around mindful parenting, I feel like she quite mindfully parents in a way that works for her, versus the way that works for me is a very different thing. So what do you think the definition of mindful parenting actually is?
Yeah, it's such a good question, and I love that you bring up social media on this note, because I have just like have just released a book in mindful parenting. I have been on social media a lot more just naturally as part of the launch, and noticing a lot of these highlight reels and different people that I'm connecting with. And, you know, there's a discomfort around sometimes the perfect reel, you know, highlight reels that we're seeing. And, you know, like, I see so many people in practice who have these beautiful Instagrams, and then they come in and you know, there's no elements of mindful parenting actually within their family. So I guess what I would say is, when we're judging it via social media, it essentially means absolutely nothing. Just because somebody's got pretty photos doing activities that look sort of Montessori style, it doesn't mean anything about their parenting. And sometimes we see people, and I'm not judging or projecting anything that's right or wrong, everything that we do in motherhood is up to us, but you know, a lot of these people who talk about mindful parenting have every second photo of their kids perfectly posed, with their hair perfectly done, and in a perfectly matching outfit that's, you know, tagging a company. And like, if you imagine the behind the scenes of that moment, I mean, it might look like mindful parenting on Instagram, but, you know, is it really the true essence? Which comes down to three core things, which is acceptance, empathy, and sovereignty. So it was initially, mindful parenting was initially sort of identified by someone called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's one of the biggest mindfulness teachers in the world, who sort of brought mindfulness to the medical world, people with chronic pain. And he has, you know, been a big game changer in bringing it to the West and bringing it into the bio sort of social medical model of how we look at illness and stress and things like that. So he defined mindful parenting. I'm going to see if I can get his definition. for you while we are here. One second. But it's more about tuning into their inner world, a way of recognizing our child's emotions in the present. Let me see if I can get it. No, I don't have it right here. I did quote it in my book. But it's basically about having a non-judgmental attitude towards our child and having full acceptance of their being that is separate to us in the moment. So when we are interacting with them, it's as simple as being present. Anything else, craft, art, the way they're dressed, where they live, none of that is relevant. Like, we can have the image of it, but unless we are connecting and all they need is us and all we need is them to be able to be practicing mindful parenting, it, there's nothing else to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's perfect. So well put. And I guess a good segue into maybe telling us a little bit about your book. So you've got a book that you've just released called Parenting Freedom. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about what we can expect to read if we get your book?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that was just released last week. It's been a bit of a passion project after I finished my PhD and published some of my research. You know, you kind of feel like the academic work just collects dust on the shelves sometimes.
Well, well done to you, because that's a lot of work. I don't think a lot of people realise the work that goes into a PhD, so I have to just congratulate you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, it's a couple of years of work and, yeah, a lot. And you kind of feel like only your supervisors and stuff read it and, you know, a couple of professors. But really the reason why I did it was out of passion for helping parents and, you know, helping them to make really practical changes and to understand how simple it is to adopt some of these parenting practices. So after I finished that, I thought, wow, I really want to create something that everyday parents can understand and relate to. And so I started that journey of writing a book, and it started off as very clinical and academic. And when I read it the first time, I was like, oh, this is not, you know, going to speak to everyday parents. This speaks to psychologists and professors. So I almost rewrote it from the start, and it's written in sort of different stories and case studies. So it's not so scientific. It sort of hopefully comes to life through the stories, kind of like some of the stories and examples I've given today. So the first part is about stress cycles and how we get stuck in all of these unhelpful dysfunctional patterns from an intergenerational level to just day to day with our kids. And the second part is about how we can break free of these patterns using lots of evidence-based strategies, mindfulness-based strategies, meditation practices for our brain and how it changes our brain. And then part three looks at the sustainability of parenting and parent-child interactions. So we talked a bit about emotional attunement today, and it gives lots of practical examples of how we can better emotionally attune and become emotion coaches for our parents, for our children, while setting boundaries with something that I've referred to as ruthless compassion in the book, ruthless compassion for our boundaries, but also for our child. So sometimes we have to say no to them for their well-being, and it helps us to move through the emotions and the discomfort of setting those boundaries. But there's sometimes, like when we say no, there's a big eruption or there's a big conflict, or we're almost punished by saying no or setting that boundary. So, you know, a lot of parents would probably be able to recall a couple of times where they've just like turned a blind eye because they can't be bothered right now. Totally understandable, but it just helps to get clarity on what the priorities are and how we can stay more consistent and and sustainability sort of for life with these practices that we can come back to without relying on a therapist or, you know, a teacher to constantly support us, a way that we can learn to support ourselves in these practices, because parenting goes on for a really long time, even when our kids are grown up. So,
sounds, those skills. Sounds wonderful. Where can our listeners find it?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. The book's called Parenting Freedom. It's on Amazon for Australia and the US, some of the Book Depository and lots of other major book online book retailers. If you have any trouble finding it, you can always jump on my website, reneekaysha.com, or find me on socials at reneekaysha PhD, and I'll always have the links to find it. But it should be available worldwide at one of those big retailers or Barnes and Nobles, anywhere like that.
It sounds like a book that every parent really needs.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I would love to hear from people once they've read it, like any reflections or if they change their perspective on something in parenting, I'd love to hear.
And I always say with any parenting book, there should be an audiobook available. Is there an audiobook available yet? There is?
There is one that has been recorded. It isn't available yet, but it will be over the next few months because I know that it can be hard to sit down and get the reading in, and I narrated it myself, so I'm really excited to share that. So yeah, if anyone's sort of interested in an audible or an audio book, keep an eye out on my socials and I'll announce when it is available as well.
Okay, great. Renee, thank you so much for taking the time out and squeezing us in just before the birth of your first baby. I've really got a lot out of this conversation and I'm sure the listeners will also. So I just want to say a big thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your well wishes and thank you for having me. It was so great to unpack these topics with you.
Thank you for listening. I have been a practitioner of naturopathic and Chinese medicine for over a decade. I have a master's degree of health science and I am an academic lecturer at Australia's leading natural medicine college. I am available worldwide online for bookings. Simply go to sandyrosshealth.com.